The chair will call the Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. And we do have a quorum, and so the very first item of business would be the adoption of our January 29th minutes, and the chair is open to a motion.
So moved.
So moved.
Chair Dean moves adoption of the January 29th minutes. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Dean. Members, we have three bills before us. And right now on the order, we have House File 464 scheduled first, Representative O'Neill. But we also have House File 491 by Representative DeMuth. DeMuth. Okay, I'll get it. And frankly, I just chatted with Representative DeMuth, and she has another committee at this time, and so we spoke with Representative O'Neill, who's graciously agreed to slide her time over so that her colleague can go first and then get on to her next committee. Barring us not asking 100 questions. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes. So with that, Representative Damon, I think that's how you pronounce it. I'm going to get it right. No, oh, she's nodding. Representative Damon, if you can come forward. And as you do that, I'm wondering, Representative Johnson, if you would care to move House File 491 to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Mr. Chair, I'd be honored to move House File 491 to set to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Johnson moves that House File 491 be referred to Ways and Means, and so we'll entertain the bill and have the conversation. Welcome, Representative DeMuth. I'm getting it, aren't I?
You are, yes.
Very well. I had the privilege to meet you for the first time actually just a few minutes ago. So welcome not only to this committee, but also to the Minnesota House. And we look forward to learning about this bill. And of course, the very first question that committee members, I can see it in their eyes already, is, Mr. Chair, we have a first termer here, you know, are there cookies to be
There are mini cupcakes.
Oh, even better.
Members, mini cupcakes. I'm seeing lots of smiles, Representative Damon, so I think we can waive the cookie rule and add cupcakes to that today.
There's one little box of cookies. I didn't know. Just wanted to cover all my bases.
Representative Damon, I'm just kind of making this stuff as I go along, so don't worry about it. very well. Representative Damon, my understanding is you also have an amendment. We chatted about this briefly. Is it your desire to have the committee act on the amendment? And my understanding is that the amendment basically puts the bill in the shape that you wish it to be before us.
I'm sorry?
My understanding is your amendment puts the bill in the shape that you wish it to be before us.
Yes, it does.
So I guess my question is whether you wish to have us move the amendment.
If we could move through with the amendment also, I'd appreciate that. Thank
you,
Chair.
Very well. You and I did chat about this. Members, the Chair is predisposed to have us entertain this amendment. There is a technical issue with the amendment in that it didn't quite make the deadline under the committee rules. And so before we move forward, I'm going to ask Representative Johnson, the maker of the motion, if you see any issues with us moving forward with this amendment, and quite frankly, particularly given the issues that were raised yesterday by yourself and other colleagues about proper posting. So I want to make sure that we're moving forward in a good spirit in terms of shaping legislation here. Representative Johnson.
With that, I have no problem.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. I think it is appropriate. As I mentioned at the very beginning of our legislative session, it is the chair's intent and understanding that the work of legislation happens in committees. It obviously happens on the floor, but the floor also has some other dynamics. And so the floor, quite frankly, is not always the best place for us to be shaping complicated complex policy decisions and arriving at agreements that both sides can own to the best that they can. That really happens here in committee members. And so having information before us to guide us and having motions that fulfill the desires and wishes of the authors who bring us the bills, to me, is not only an accommodating thing, but it's a fair thing to do. And beyond that, it's a smart thing to do. So that in the end, we come up with legislation that is broadly owned and broadly understood. And so with that, Representative Maybeth, the chair is, in fact, disposed to waive the 24-hour rule on this amendment. Oh, some people can't hear me. I guess I had to talk louder or lean into this thing. Hold on a second. And then so, Representative Johnson, I'm wondering if, as the maker of the, motion, if you will then so move the amendment to your motion.
I will move amendment. Looks like it's...
Oh, we need a number. That's right.
The A1 amendment.
Very well. So Representative Johnson moves the A1 amendment. Representative Chair Dean has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to note that, you know, we spent 40 minutes yesterday morning discussing whether or not the Attorney General could present to our group. And I just want folks to know that, you know, sometimes we do need to waive rules because it's important that we get our work done here. And I do not have any objection to us waiving the 24-hour rule for this amendment so that the author can have the bill in the shape that they'd like. But I just want to note it for the record that sometimes it's important to just waive the rules, and we can actually save a lot of time versus debating or not whether to waive the rules or not waive the rules on a particular issue.
Representative Dean, Chairman Dean, I concur. And as I indicated, for me, this has more to do with shaping good public policy as opposed to figuring out which side is actually right, quote unquote, on an issue. We'll have plenty of time to do that on the floor of the House, believe me, members. I do think that Representative Dameth has a good amendment and, frankly, a good bill before us. So my hope is that we can have a constructive conversation here. With that, members, are there any questions? Actually, it just puts the bill in the language that the author wishes, and so we can entertain questions once that's shaped up relative to this language and the rest of the language of the bill. So with that, then, members, all in favor of the Johnson amendment, which is the A1 amendment, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Dameth, your bill is before us in the shape you wish it to be. So,
thank you very much, Chair Mariani.
Please tell us about it.
Thank you. Chair Mariani, it's good to be here, committee. It is a privilege to be in front of you. I do have this stack of cupcakes and a couple of cookies. Can I hand that off to someone now, or when is that appropriate?
I think it's appropriate, Representative Dameth, right now. Thank you.
Thank you again.
And for the record, I want you to know that no goods here are meant to influence the eventual vote.
Oh, no. I think there's always room for a treat. So, again, thank you. It is very good to be here. It is good to be serving in the House. My name is Lisa Dameth, and I am from District 13A, which is in Stearns County. When this bill came before me, what I realized is that it is not just specific to my area, but all the way across. And so thank you for hearing House File 491. The bill was brought to me and brought forward from Dakota County Attorney James Backstrom, who is with me today. After reviewing the bill, Mr. Backstrom suggested some changes to me, and I'll work with him and future committees on getting the right language as the bill continues to move forward. I do want to clarify the position of authority definition applies to high school students who are 18 to 21. So I would like to have the A1 amendment offered, and since you've accepted that, thank you again. I appreciate that. There were two cases in Dakota County involving high school teachers and coaches who had sexual relations with 18-year-old high school students. Our criminal sexual conduct laws make this conduct a crime if the student is 17. But when that student turns 18, it is currently no longer a crime. The law needs to be changed. Students are vulnerable in school with people in positions of authority over them, such as teachers or coaches. The fact that a high school student turns 18 doesn't change the dynamics of the student and the teacher in the classroom, or the student with their coach, or on a field or in a gym. Students can be easily manipulated, especially when the threat of needing to get good grades is looming over them. I happen to have served on the Ricourie School Board for 11 years prior to coming to the House, and I didn't realize this loophole existed. So when it came to my attention, like I said, it's not just my district, but to me it means public safety, student safety, and the well-being for our communities and our school. The other thing is I have four children, and one of my daughters turned 18 the week before she started her senior year in high school, and that also made it very personal to me. So House File 491 addresses this issue. It's narrowly crafted to apply to only high school students who have not graduated and school employees, contractors, or volunteers who are in a position of authority over the student. And I think that's a really important piece, is to realize that those people are in authority over the student. I am now going to turn it over to my testifier, Dakota County Attorney Jim Backstrom.
County Attorney Backstrom, welcome to the committee. It's my first time entertaining you as a chair here, but I've been following your career for many years. Your my district actually abuts at West St. Paul, Dakota County. So it's a privilege to meet you, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a privilege to be here. I am in my 32nd year as the Dakota County Attorney, so I have been around for quite some time. And I appreciate the willingness of Representative Daymuth to take this bill up and bring it forward. It's an important change in the law that needs to be made. As the representative indicated, we have had two cases in Dakota County in recent years, one involving a teacher, one involving a coach of a 18-year-old high school student who had not yet graduated, who was engaged in a sexual relationship with that teacher and coach, and it's clearly something that I believe is not okay. And I think you could ask any parent out there, and my kids are a little older now, but I have grandkids that have just graduated from high school recently, and listen, it's just simply not all right for someone who's in a position of authority over a high school student, and it could be up to age 21 for special needs students that might not graduate until they're age 21, if you're wondering where that the 21 age came from. But there's quite a few students, like Representative Damas' daughter, who are 18 while they're in their senior year of high school. And it just simply is not okay for those individuals to be manipulated into a sexual relationship, which can have long-term negative emotional harm to those individuals. And I've seen it happen in the two cases that we dealt with, and unfortunately I had to tell both of those victims, I'm sorry, but there's simply no law in our state that makes this a crime. And that's what this bill is all about. It's an important change in our law to correct this gap in the criminal sexual conduct statutes so these 18-year-old students will have the same protection of any other high school student. 18 to 21-year-old high school students will have the same protection as any 16 or 17-year-old high school student who is involved in a sexual relationship with someone in a position of authority at those institutions. You know, the long-term negative impact on these kids, it can be significant, and that is something that none of us want to see occur. Under this bill, neither a mistake as to the complainant's age or consent by the complainant is a defense. Someone is in a position of authority over that student at a school institution that is providing part of their high school education, and they have not yet graduated, it becomes a felony offense under this proposal, and in my view, rightfully so. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have regarding the language. It amends both 609.344 and 609.345 to add provisions to those statutes to address this issue. And the definition of position of authority, which was the A1 amendment that you incorporated this morning, is important because without that definition change, position of authority under the current language just refers to a child, which means someone under the age of 18. So it's important to change that definition to coincide with the changes in these particular statutes as well. So thank you for the opportunity to be here to support this important proposal. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
excuse me, County Attorney Baxter, there are some questions. Very quickly, maybe for the chair's sake, can you expound a little bit more on the significance of the position of authority idea and principle? Because obviously we're talking about victims that would be over the would be adults under the law, but they're in a secondary setting. And so maybe just expound a little bit about what does that mean in the real world when there's a position of authority relative to perhaps the ability to commit a crime and do so with, you know, minimal fear of retaliation, but also what is the dynamic there that facilitates that kind of behavior, if you will?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As you, I'm sure, all know, the age of consent for sexual relationships is 16 under Minnesota law. However, under current law, if you're age 16 or 17 and you're in a high school, and it is a felony for someone in a position of authority over a high school student who's 16 or 17 years old if they have sexual contact or sexual relationships with that student. This bill, again, will extend this to those students who are 18 up to 21 for the special needs students that have not yet graduated from high school so that there cannot be any sexual contact, even if they consent. And you have to remember, these are young people who whose brains are not fully developed. As we all know, brains are not fully developed until you reach your early to mid-20s. And while, yes, they may consent to this, they don't really fully understand yet at that point in time in their life what the implications of a sexual relationship with someone who is much older than them and who is actually teaching them or providing oversight to them as a coach or as a school administrator working with those individuals or as a school counselor or whatever the situation might be. That's a situation where I think those students can be easily manipulated into a relationship which is harmful to them and could be very harmful in the long term in terms of the trauma that might be inflicted. Because these students, after these relationships end, then they often realize the mistakes that they have made and that's when it really starts to come home to them how difficult it is. And I remember meeting with a young woman who went through one of these situations, and she was at that time in her mid-20s and finishing up college, early to mid-20s. And this relationship had caused such trauma to her. It was a very hard conversation to have with that young woman, as I explained that unfortunately there was nothing in our laws that would make this behavior a crime. I truly believe this is important, that these types of relationships can have long-term negative impacts on vulnerable youth, and we should not allow this to occur, and we should treat this the same as we do for the 16 or 17-year-old high school students that have not yet graduated. If someone is older than that but still is in that high school setting, the law should be the same. So that's the crux of the bill, and again, I'm happy to answer further questions.
Thank you, County Attorney Baxter. We do have several questions. Chair Dean, we'll start with you, and then we'll move on to Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative DeMuth or to County Attorney Baxter, when I look at this, it looks like what's being added is the issue around ages of 16 years to 21 years in a student in secondary school. Who has not graduated. And in section one, say on page 2.13, there is a 48-month sort of exception made if the individual is less than 48 months. Does that 48-month exception transfer in the new language, or is this sort of absent the 48-month older rule that applies in the first section?
Mr. Chair and Representative,
I'll be answering your answer.
That 48-month language is applicable to this change, just as it's applicable to the 16 or 17-year-old high school student. And again, that's to reflect that there might be some student teachers or somebody that's not you know, more than 4 years older than the person, and that is a different situation. It is under current law, and it would continue to be that way with these 18 to 21-year-old students.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before I get to my question, I'd like to clarify. So if you have a 21, 22-year-old student teacher, a brand new teacher, then they would be exempt from having the? Whoa. Not terribly comfortable with that. But my question is I know that, like, with therapists, there is a, I think it's either a year or 2 years after they have treated somebody that they're supposed to not engage in sexual relations. Is this just as soon as they graduate, the day after the graduation, it's over, or is there any kind of extended period after that? I didn't see that anywhere.
Mr. Chair,
County Attorney Master.
Representative, there would not be any extension beyond the graduation from the high school setting. And again, we're trying to make the law consistent with current law as it applies to a 16 or 17-year-old student. Once that student under current law turns 18, then it would not be a crime for that student to have a sexual relationship with a teacher. Under this law, it would become a crime as long as they're still a high school student. But once they graduate from high school, then it would not be a criminal offense. And yes, it is a little different in different professions for therapists and doctors and clergy and the like. But again, we were looking at this bill as what's current law and trying to expand it to make sure that we don't overlook these students that have not yet graduated that are in these situations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Baxter.
Very well. Representative Grossel.
I thought I waved you off.
Okay.
I mistakenly waved my hand, but then I said no.
Quite all right. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a piggyback, actually, on what Chair Considine's question was. And also, thanks to both of you for being here. And Representative Damu, you've set the bar really high for treats. I'm presenting tomorrow. So just want to know you to know that now the bar is set very high. So thank you. So there is a separate bill that's looking at extending the look-back period for position of authority cases. I believe Representative O'Neill has that in her bill. And so I don't know if this is a question or more of a comment, that this would be something that if we change this statute, would we need to look at also amending that look-back period in the other position of authority bill?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was what I was going to talk about. And so it's a definition, is position of authority as one of the definitions. And so any place that you see position of authority within the statutes, it does refer directly to that definition. And I do have a, out of my bill that I was going to hear today, there, out of the five parts, one part is extending that relationship point to 120 days after that event has ended, so after they're no longer a coach or a teacher. So it would be extending that 120 days past that date. And if this is amended, the statute is amended, then that would also, it would all work together. And so it would get to what Chair Considine had been talking about not just when that activity has ended, but actually they're still liable for 120 days after. And that was actually, since we have a senator in the room, that was a Senate compromise position of 120 days. And I know the advocates really wanted a full year. So I decided to go with something less controversial because there are other parts of the bill that are that need to be worked out and discussed very thoroughly and vetted thoroughly. But that part was a compromised position, was 120 days past that point of activity. But thank you for bringing that up.
Representative Baldwin?
That's good. Thanks.
Uh, child. And I'm told by staff that Representative Wasilek also has a bill on this issue. So we'll have this conversation a few times to make sure that we're being consistent. Representative Chairman Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question relates to what if you got an 18-year-old in like a community college? They're still 18, and they're having sex with their professor in the community college. Would that be illegal under this bill?
Mr. Chair?
County Attorney Baxter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, that is an issue that I'm hoping to work with Representative Damuth on and getting some additional definition added to what a secondary school means, because in my view, the definition should include a situation where a high school student is taking a class at Inverhills College and that professor is having sex with that student. I think it should apply. That student has not yet graduated from high school. And but that under the current language of the bill, I don't believe that that's addressed. But I do have some language that I'm going to ask her to consider at a future meeting.
Chairman Lesh.
Okay. Well, now that just gives me more questions, because I wasn't talking about community college in high school. I was originally talking about if they had graduated and they were at community college. Is that illegal?
If they
under this bill.
Mr. Chair,
County Attorney Baxter.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. The bill right now relates to students who have not yet graduated from a secondary school, a high school, or a secondary school, and there's whether it's public, non-public, homeschool, that type of a thing. That if they're still in that setting, the secondary school setting, then the proposal would apply. And there's a lot of high school students that take classes at colleges, so that does occur.
Okay, so well, Chairman Mariani, I know you're a really good lawyer, Mr. Baxter, but that was a very lawyer answer. I think what you meant to say is no, right?
Thank you, Mr. Representative.
Okay, so if you graduated from high school and you're going to community college, technically, legally, you may think that it should be illegal. I get it, but it's not illegal now. Is that right?
Yes.
Under this bill, it's not illegal, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, yes, it's not illegal under this bill, and I'm not proposing that become illegal if they've graduated from high school and are attending college. That's not covered in this bill.
Okay. So thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Beckstrom. So then that brings me to the question that I have that you brought up about, so college and schools. So my daughter is 18, and she's going to St. Paul Central right now, and she's got a bunch of friends who take college and schools. So under your language of a person – of a position in authority, they're not an employee, I don't think, of the school district. I don't know how they, okay. So you got a U of M professor who's showing up at St. Paul Central and having sex with a student who is taking college and school. But then the next classroom over, someone's taking the same class, but it's not a college and school class, it's an AP or, I forget all the titles, IB or something. And that teacher's having sex with a student, that would be illegal under this bill. Is that right?
County Attorney Baxter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, the definition of independent contract that's currently in this bill means any person who contracts with a secondary school to provide, educational services. So, and I assume there's contracts with those institutions. So it very well may be covered under here, under the current language and the definition of secondary school that's in this proposal. It's my understanding that there is a little broader definition of the term secondary school, which is in the Senate version of this bill, which would more clearly define that it would include other settings that might be outside of the high school itself where a student is getting educated while they're still in high school and haven't yet graduated from their secondary school. So I hope that answers your question.
And Representative Johnson, I think, wants to weigh in. I'll come back, but I think, yes.
Okay.
Just on this point, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, if you look at line 2.16, one of the requirements for this particular portion of the bill to kick in is the student has not graduated from high school yet.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And Mr. Backstrom. So then you got a kid who is in community college. And essentially what you want to do is you want to move the line for these kids just simply based on graduation. You don't like the 18 demarcation. You prefer the graduated from high school demarcation, right? Well, if I can ask Mr. Chair, in this country we have a pretty long and storied history of having 18 as the age of the majority. Why is it getting that diploma? Why is that a better demarcation for you, or for the author, I guess I should probably ask, than turning 18? What's the difference? Is it just because it's a little bit later? It could be like a few months later, or what?
County Attorney Baxter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, in my view, a student who is still in secondary school, has not yet graduated, or up to age 21 if it's a special needs student, but it's typically 18 for many high school seniors that turn 18 during that year. Why should it be a crime? Why should it be a felony for a teacher to have sex with that student when they're 17 years old, when they're in a position of authority over that student, and yet the day after, when they're still in high school, they turn 18, now it's legal? I don't think so. I mean, that's not the way the law should work. They're still in a secondary school setting. They haven't graduated, and we need to treat those students in the same manner if someone is in a position of authority and is manipulating that student into a sexual relationship that's inappropriate, it's wrong, it shouldn't occur, and that's what this bill does.
Well, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, and I appreciate your passion on that, Mr. Backstrom, but, you know, I had a friend when I was a freshman who was 18 and was having sex with a professor. Why should that not be a felony? I mean, my point relates more to where we're drawing a line than whether it's wrong or not. It's, you know, where you draw, do you draw the line at 18 or did you draw a line? It's that diploma thing that for you is really important. And I get that. I mean, that can be your thing. You know, for me, historically, this legislature has, I guess, punted on certain issues with respect to whether we use the age of majority or not. It's not the first time, you know, drinking, hunting, whatever, we go either down or above it. Marriage, you know. So that's what I just wanted to know is why the diploma was the most important part to you. And for some people it is. But I'll read it a little bit more, Mr. Chair, too.
It's a fair enough question, Representative. I think that is precisely the kind of deliberation that we want to engage in. Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me think. So first, I guess, just addressing, because when I think about this, and I generally think this makes a lot of sense, and I don't think of it so much from the perspective of the student, the potential victim in the case, but from the perspective of the perpetrator, and just thinking that there's something about the context of secondary schools. So I'm not quite sure, County Attorney Backstrom, if I would agree necessarily, if you have an 18-year-old who's in community college, they haven't graduated yet. I'm just thinking about the setting from when I would think about this. I think there's something about the setting of secondary school that I think does change that relationship, that opportunity for exploitation in a way that perhaps post-secondary school does not. We can discuss that. But the general thought that somebody who's in secondary school, that context, I guess for me, seems like an important point. I do want to just clarify something that was discussed earlier. As I review this particular language, I feel like it appears to me that 48-month limitation does not apply to the new language. So I guess the way that I read this is that there would not be that restriction of 48 months. I don't mean to contradict the county attorney. Maybe I'm not reading that right. But I guess if that is the goal, we may want to take another look at the language to make sure that is, in fact, how this language would work, because I'm not sure that it appears to me that language is only restricting clause 1 and not clause 2 in subsection E there. And then I had one question. Maybe I'll pause on that just to see if that makes sense to the county attorney, if he thinks I'm maybe misreading that, Mr. Chair.
County Attorney Baxter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, it was not my intent to eliminate the 48-month requirement, that should be the same. And I had read this as the 48 months would apply to both Clause 1 and Clause 2. But if you believe that we need to clarify that further, we're happy to do that.
Okay.
Chairman Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that and we can take some more look at it, maybe have House Research take a look as well. And presumably there's some language tweaking that can be done if necessary. And so speaking of which, I want to get back to the point originally made about making changes along the way. Where is this bill, Mr. Chair, if you can remind me, where this bill would go next, assuming it passes through this committee?
Chairman Pinto, my understanding is that this language in the past has gone to education, and the intent is to set it to Ways and Means so that it travels that way. Again, quite frankly, it would be the chair's desire that the bill come back to us once it makes that stop in K-12.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that makes sense to me then, because I am concerned about how this fits in with the other proposals regarding position of authority. I know that MNCOS, other groups have worked for a long time on a set of proposals. I know the county attorney's worked for a long time on this. He had spoken with me about it previously. I know Representative O'Neill has her proposal. And I guess I want to make sure that as a committee we'll get a chance to consider the set of position of authority proposals kind of all together. But if it's the chair's intent to bring this back, then I guess there's that opportunity. But in general, I think that it does make sense that there should be that secondary school environment is one where we do want to make sure to recognize that there's an opportunity for greater exploitation there. So thank you to the county attorney and to Representative Damuth for bringing this forward. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chairman Pinto. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Backstrom, you'll be happy to know I'm not an attorney, so I'm going to be asking a much more pedestrian question here. I get, thank you very much for doing this, Representative Damuth, by the way. I hate when I see little loopholes like this, and I believe in the authority over children and stuff like that, and so when we can't protect them in those authority positions, I think we need to do something. But when I see some of this stuff, I see a difference between a criminal offense and a willingness to prosecute. So I have kind of two quick questions related to that. First of all, in your opinion, are county attorneys going to actively prosecuting when this happens? And I guess the second part to that is what would be the typical plea agreement down from this? Because there's in some other parts of criminal law that we've come across, particularly in sexual offenses, to where the perpetrator kind of gets away with it because they plea, right? Or there's other administrative things that happen. So what does this look like in the real world?
Mr. Chair, Representative, to answer your question, yes, county attorneys will prosecute this offense. We do prosecute the current offenses that involve 16 or 17-year-old students under these situations who are in high school that have had a sexual relationship with someone in a position of authority. And I'm confident that my colleagues will prosecute the addition to this statute. I know I certainly will. In terms of your second part of the question is a little harder to answer because, it does rest with the discretion of the prosecutor, in this case the county attorney, to make a determination as to what appropriate penalty to seek for the violation of a crime. Ultimately, it's up to the judge. And this will be ranked under sentencing guidelines the same way it's ranked for the 16 or 17-year-old high school students. The ranking is going to be the same. I think these cases will be handled the same. I don't have right now, but I could bring it back at a later point when this bill returns, but I don't have answers right now as to what a typical sentence might be, but I can certainly find out for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Dean?
No.
All right, very well. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh brings up some questions as I'm reading through this, and you've put it just before the line that says neither mistake as to the complainant's age nor consent by the act of the complainant is a defense. So it's mistake of age and consent is not a consideration. And so I'm thinking really the demarcation line is the diploma not the age. And so that doesn't fit together. So if you say mistake of age is not a defense, but it's not so much the age as it is have they graduated or not, there's an inconsistency now that you've created. So I just wanted to point that out, that there's a pretty strong inconsistency with that defense, or lack of defense, I should say. The mistake of age is not a defense, nor is consent. So you might want to think about, since we're not going strictly by age, and now it has to do with the diploma, that those, it doesn't work together anymore.
County Attorney Baxter, would you care to comment on that? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I certainly understand the point you're raising, and we can take a further look at that, and I can speak with the House counsel about that aspect. But certainly it's the consent language needs to remain in this statute, and the mistake as to age, if we now eliminate this and make it up to age 21 if they're still in high school, I can understand where that perhaps doesn't necessarily apply anymore. So you're right, and we can work on correcting that.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to circle back a little bit to a couple of issues. One's dealing with the student teacher. As I read this, I don't believe the 48-month rule applies. Because if you look at the bill, it talks about the age 16 and the 48 months, but in the clause 2, it goes or. There are two separate issues. This bill deals solely with position of authority. If a student teacher is teaching, that person would be in a position of authority, and this would apply. If the student drops out of school and no longer is in school and 18 years of age, it would not apply because they're not in a position of authority. This bill deals strictly with those students in high school and post-secondary, ages 18 up to 21. Most will be out by 18. And I think this is a good bill, and I really appreciate you bringing this forward. It's something that needs to be done.
Mr. Chair and Representative, as I stated earlier, it was not my intent to eliminate the 48-month requirement. I was reading this as that applied to both Clause 1 and Clause 2. We can certainly just reword that language a little bit to make that perfectly clear, and I'm happy to work with the author and on an amendment to do that.
Chairman Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up on two small points. To Representative O'Neill's question about mistake or point about mistake as to age, I think it does, it is still necessary, helpful to have, both under Clause 1, if you don't have a school situation that somebody can say, well, I thought that she was 18, right? And then, but even under Clause 2, and remember that we're trying to cover every possible exception, kind of this is how we're trying to set up. So if you have a special needs student who is 20 years old, and so this would apply, but the person says, oh, I thought that she was 21, right? So there is still an age situation there. So just, and it's true, we could add a third item that is not a defense, namely, oh, I thought that she had graduated, but we don't have to add that as a defense, right? But regardless, I think these two defenses would still be necessary, be helpful if we decide, and I guess I would think would be in favor of that under this situation as well. Because there is still an age limit, even if it goes up to 21. There might be some situation that applies. And then to the 48 months, it sounds like there may be two different issues going on here. One is how this is written and what the goal of the author and County Attorney Backstrom is. I guess I was hearing former Chair Johnson, Representative Johnson, making the point, though, he's kind of wondering whether, in fact, the 48 months is necessary or would be desirable for this. I will say to that, just to point out that the way this is written, if someone is a volunteer at the school, but acting in a way where they have any of the parents, any of the kinds of responsibilities that somebody would have for the young person, they would be in a position of authority. So I could imagine you might have an 18-year-old and then a 19-year-old volunteer or 20-year-old volunteer. Certainly there's always edge cases and prosecutors have to have discretion to deal with them, but I guess I would probably in general think that 48 months is not a bad thing to keep even in this new proposal. And it sounds like that's the county attorney's intent and the author's as well. So just something for us to address. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative or Chairman Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I always have questions when we mess around with the age of majority on certain items, and like I said, we do. When I was 18 in high school, I got this little pamphlet that said your rights and responsibilities at 18, and you flipped through that and said, okay, with certain things you have to do contracts, and you actually have to pay back your bills, because remember, before 18, the contract, any contract is voidable. And there's this long list of stuff. What's that? So, yeah, absolutely. I still have my selective service card too, which is interesting. I came up with that when I was cleaning out my office. Actually, when I moved my office this last time, I had my selective service card in there. I don't know why, but I remember reading that pamphlet and going down all this list of stuff that could be done to me now, or that I had to do, or what I was accountable for. Because I was being 18. And it always makes me a little nervous when we modify that, no matter which way we do it, because it reminds me of the lyrics of that old Soul Asylum song, you try to do the right thing, but the right thing changes from state to state. And when you tell an 18-year-old kid in a pamphlet, here's what you got to do or you can't do, or here's what you're accountable for, it's simplicity is always much easier than complexity. And we are inherently making this a little bit more complex for, I think, ostensibly good reasons, right? You don't want high school teachers having sex with high school kids. You do not want that to happen. But I think it's a legitimate question to ask. Well, then what does that do to the autonomy and conscience of an 18-year-old kid? Now at 18... it still depends a whole lot on a lot of different things. And that's why I tend to support 18 in almost all things without changing it, even if we have a good reason to modify it, lower or higher for whatever reason. But I think that when we're deliberating this, I've heard a lot of people talking about, well, we got to get the bad guy, which is a good principle, and that's Mr. Backstrom's job. But I think one of the things we also have to deliberate is, what are we doing to explain to a kid when they turn 18, or when they're responsible for their actions, or when they're in a position to say no to a teacher or yes to a person in a position of authority, wherever? Because I'm wondering, like, okay, when you get to college, what goes on when you get to college? And that we all know that that's inappropriate. Most colleges have policies in opposition to that. But we're talking about a criminal situation here now. So I think that's something that's kind of left out in these, is a question of autonomy and conscience in what we expect of our young people and when we expect that of them. Because when we make laws like this, we inherently are modifying that. We are. And it's something that I think needs to be remembered. You are modifying the conscience and autonomy of a young person, and it's legitimate to do that at any age, but you can't just not talk about it. You got to have the conversation and tell your kids, okay, here's what you got to watch out for, and here's when you have to watch out for it. So I just wanted to raise that, Mr. Chair. I don't expect that many people are concerned about that on a philosophical level, about what we expect of our kids, but that's the kind of thing that I think about, especially when I have an 18-year-old daughter in high school. I'm thinking about it. What can I tell her, what she has to watch out for, and when? So that's it. That's all I wanted to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Gossel.
Representative, the Chair, Representative Lesch.
I'm sorry, Representative Johnson. I called on Representative Gossel. And I will speak louder. My
getting
apologies.
Greedy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at this bill, and I'm understanding the overall concept of it. I'm understanding the 48-month part. I'm understanding the next section with the age that you've age range that you've chosen. But I think that's throwing a loop. That's throwing a kind of a wrench in what way some people are thinking here. Would you please explain why you chose that age range,
Mr. Backstrom?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I chose the age range to ensure that we include the special needs students who are still in a high school setting, have not graduated from high school, that may not graduate until they're 21. And that's where I picked that, you know, particular upper end of the range. And for most of the students that we're discussing, 18 would be the applicable number. But there are some special needs students that don't graduate that until a later point in time, and that's why I chose that particular range.
Representative Russell, follow-up?
So help me understand that I believe 21 is the cutoff for students to be in secondary school, is it not?
I believe that's the case. I do believe that's the case, but I'd have to do a little research on that.
Members, we are going to have to move this bill along here, partly because I personally promised Representative Namath I'd get her to her committee. You may want to call ahead and have yourself excused, quite frankly. But we also do have two other bills that I want to make sure we get to today. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, a little follow-up on what Representative Lesh said, and maybe I can possibly let him understand the situation with these high school kids in the position of authority. Even though they're 18, 19, they might be 20 years old, up to 21. Last year, when I chaired the Public Safety and Judiciary Committee, I had to deal with a person in a position of authority, a chair of a very powerful committee. I was very nervous and to the point of almost being scared, having to tell that chair that I refused to hear his bill in my committee. I could imagine an 18-year-old trying to tell a teacher that, no, I do not want to go with you to this place. I know I was, as chair of the committee, I was nervous talking to the other chair. Could you imagine, just think about an 18, 19-year-old doing that.
Members, I'm going to ask John Walsh quickly to talk a little bit about fiscal costs. We have some history with language like this, and so I'm wondering if Mr. Walsh could share with us the history of similar language to this last year, what you can tell us in terms of your understanding of the bill as it's presently constructed relative to fiscal costs.
Mr. Chair, a fiscal note request has been put in for this bill. It was not completed as of this hearing. We did carry, there was identical language last year by Representative Christensen, and there was not a fiscal note done to that bill. However, we carried a somewhat similar bill by Representative Lohmer, which was House File 3203, and that had to do with persons of a recent position of authority, and that carried about a one prison bed per year cost. So it was $14,000 in the first year and $22,000 in the second. This bill may come back with a similar cost in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. It's very helpful. Members, I'd like us to move forward. It is my intention to bring this back. It sounds like there's some really good ideas from both sides of the aisle, issues that have been raised that I suspect Representative Namath is taking quite serious and will work with you, with all of us, when we have the bill back before us. So, Representative Namath, with that, any... as we're about, actually, I should ask if there's anyone else in the room that wishes to testify for or against the bill. If not, then Representative Namath, you get the last word, and then we'll take a vote.
Chair Mariani, committee members, thank you for the discussion, the questions that were raised. I now have a page of notes, and that I appreciate the process. Thanks for giving us time today and for allowing me to bring this bill and for hearing it.
Terrific. With that, then Representative Johnson renews his motion. Representative Johnson.
I was going to renew the motion, but is this Ways, Means, and then to Education?
I think that is the intent. I think the motion is just simply to refer to Ways and Means. But for the record, that is certainly our intent. So Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 491 as amended be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Namath, thank you so much.
Thank you.
County Attorney Baxter, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Hopefully you'll get to your next committee on time. And thanks for the cupcakes. Representative O'Neill, House File 464. And members, we have 30 minutes, and so my hope is that we get our third bill through. Okay.
Were you in public safety in the last 2 years?
Please, Representative O'Neill. Bless you. And so the we have 30 minutes. We had originally scheduled 10 minutes for these next two bills. But we have a good, 50 minutes on each. Hopefully that'll work. And I suspect, particularly this next bill, I think we could probably strongly move this forward. And actually, Representative O'Neill, let's have your motion here. At this point, the motion is to move the bill. I think the formal motion is to refer to Ways and Means, but it is the intent of the chair that we lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So would you like me to make a motion? And please, if so, which one would you like me to make, the layover or move to Ways and Means?
The motion would be to refer to Ways and Means. The chair will then lay the bill on the table.
Very good. I would make a motion that the committee would recommend to pass and wait and move to wait, excuse me, House File 6. Let me start over. Make a motion to move House File 464 with recommendation to pass to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, committee. And this is a really exciting bill because this is something that Minnesota has never done before. And I love to do things that are like nation leading. So I look at this as Minnesota has always been a leader in the nation in all kinds of things, and this is no exception. This bill would actually create a grant program to fund programs that help domestic abusers. So we have always helped the victims of domestic violence. This would actually help transform the lives of those that are the abuser. Because if you want to stop the crisis, if you want to stop the abuse, then we need to change the behavior of the abuser. And so this sets up a $5 million in 20 and $5 million in 21 to go from the general fund through the Commissioner of Public Safety to deposit in what's called a Domestic Abuse Transformation Program account. So it's a special revenue account from which the grants would be made. And from that, I'd like to turn over to my testifiers because we are short on time and they can tell you more about this transformation program.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Chair Mariani and members of the committee, I'm Liz Richards. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. We're a statewide organization with 93 member programs providing services in all 87 counties. I'm testifying today in support of House File 464, seeking $5 million a year in funding for programming to transform the behavior of domestic violence perpetrators. Minnesota has a long history of financially supporting domestic violence work. In 1978, when state government funding for domestic violence first began, that funding was handled by the Department of Corrections. It has since been transferred over to the Office for Justice Programming. But when funding began, a decision was made that those governmental dollars would go to advocacy and services just for victims and not for perpetrators. That funding decision has not been revisited, and it's time for us to do that. We know that a conviction, incarceration, or probation alone does not necessarily result in an offender changing their behavior. We might be able to provide an individual safety, get them into shelter, help them leave a relationship. But unless we change perpetrators' behaviors, there's always going to be another victim. We know that one in four adult women will experience domestic violence during their lifetime. Here in Minnesota, more than 55,000 adults seek services from our domestic violence advocacy programs every year, and we know that less than 50% of those experiencing domestic violence ever reach out for services. In terms of perpetration, what do we know? We know that 60% of all of the offenders who are in the custody of the Department of Corrections have documented histories of domestic violence. One of the things that we do at the Coalition is we track domestic violence homicides in this state. And the Coalition has been tracking those homicides for the past 30 years. And since 1989, there have been nearly 1,000 Minnesotans who have been killed due to domestic violence. That's primarily women, some men, children killed during domestic violence instances, bystanders and interveners, including police officers. What we know is that many of the perpetrators of domestic violence had a history before the actual murder. It's a prior criminal record, or they had a family court protective order. In 2015, we looked at the BCA criminal history data and found that 60% of those who had committed domestic homicides that year had documented histories. 18% of those people had documented histories of domestic violence against a different victim. So each point of contact, either in criminal court or family court, are times where we might have made a difference. We need to ask whether if we had gotten the perpetrator into an effective programming, would it have permitted the homicide? So the coalition has also done interviews with survivors, asking them what they needed from the criminal justice system in order to be safe. And here are just two quotations, and these were echoed by many of the survivors. The first, "I will feel safe if I knew he was getting help. There has to be something done, otherwise he will never change." And the second, "His mom beat him all the time. His dad beat his mom. He needs help. They need to get him help because otherwise his next victim will not make it out alive. It's not just about me." So asking for an investment in programming to transform domestic violence perpetrators' behavior, we need a system that has accountability and monitoring, and we need effective and accessible programming. So here to talk about the programming for domestic violence perpetrators is Dave Matthews.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Welcome, sir, to the committee. Please give us your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. I am Dave Matthews, not that Dave Matthews. Sorry to disappoint. With a doctorate in psychology, and I am a licensed independent clinical social worker. I'm the program manager of the Outpatient Mental Health, Domestic Abuse, and Anger Management Services at People Incorporated. We provide perpetrator domestic abuse groups in St. Paul, Minneapolis, and in Coon Rapids. I've worked for over 30 years on programming for perpetrators of domestic violence. I've also worked with victim survivors, children, and parents in communities where violence or trauma has been experienced. My role is People Incorporated as the program manager. I am also currently facilitating men's domestic abuse groups on a weekly basis. In the past, I am proud to have worked at places such as the Wilder Foundation, Casa de Esperanza, Domestic Abuse Project, Cornerstone Advocacy Services, and through my part-time private practice that I've done for 27 years, and now I'm proud to say that I'm at People Incorporated providing this work. And People Incorporated is very supportive of this bill as well. I certainly want to acknowledge and honor all those who have gone before me and provided me information and a foundation for me to be here, providing you my humble perspective and support for this bill, HF 464. We know that domestic violence is a learned behavior, and that while not all abused children grow up to become abusers, most who have been abusive to their current or former partners do grow up in abusive homes. I've heard directly from victim survivors and heard their voices echoed in many of their, many times when I've talked with them, have echoed that they want accountability. And as we heard in the statements that were already read given by Liz, that in hopes for change and hope that the abuse stops, not only for them, but for their children and for any future victims. So in terms of looking at effective programming, there's been considerable work done around what type of programming is effective when working with perpetrators of domestic violence. Evaluation has shown that programs that incorporate education, respectful methods, and accountability measures in a group setting over 24 weeks can be most successful. There's not just one approach or model, but these elements have been found to be critical for successful programming. We need to have a variety of programming to address these different needs. And here, primarily in the Twin Cities, there's a number of programs that exist or have programs that are ready to move forward. The Domestic Abuse Project has developed their veterans programming, Change Step, which addresses the unique realities of veterans who perpetrate domestic violence. The program in Duluth, the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project, has adopted their model to work with perpetrators who have a strong Christian background. The Division of Indian Works has a program with perpetrators that addresses issues of historical trauma and realities of Native communities. There is a Hmong Men's Domestic Abuse Group program in the that's the only one in the region that's located, that provides their services in St. Paul. La Oportunidad has done the groups for Spanish-speaking Latino men for more than 20 years. An Oasis of Love and the Family Partnership and Phyllis Wheatley Center have also provided African-American-centric and specific domestic abuse services. These are a few examples of the domestic abuse violence-specific programming happening in the state, and again, most of those are within the Twin Cities area. Unfortunately, none of these programs can do it all for their respective communities. There's continued and increasing need for community members to have choice, and HF 464 can potentially not only help strengthen the existing programs, but will help to develop more quality providers across the state. And what is happening across the state? In Minnesota, we have no consistency in programming for perpetrators of domestic violence. Some counties have domestic violence-specific programming with the elements that I just talked about. Other counties use mental health counselors or have programs that have staff who have not been adequately trained or are understanding of the best practices for conducting and providing these services, and they are frankly not effective, and in some cases could even be further damaging. 40% of the counties in Minnesota have nothing available. Only a third of Minnesota counties have programming that is specific to domestic violence. Even in those counties with domestic violence-specific programming, it is often one program for the full county. We provided you in your materials with a map of the state showing what type of programming is available in which counties. This is based off of information that we gathered through county probation departments in 2018. Clearly, we lack access and quality programming.
I'm going to step back in and just address quickly a few gaps. So what are the gaps that we have right now? So clearly, what Dave Matthews has highlighted is gaps in quality programming across the state that just aren't available in the counties. The other thing is we have funding instability that has resulted in programs closing or scaling back services. Programs rely upon private foundations, individual donors, and participants' fees themselves. And when foundations shift their funding priorities, we will see that our programs struggle to stay open. Just in the last few years, this happened when the Greater Twin Cities United Way, which had been funding some of this work, shifted their funding focus. And a number of those programs receiving that money are no longer able to provide services. We have a program in Mankato, the CADA program. They run two programs for perpetrators. They work 100% off of participant fees. They charge $25 a week for participating in their program. It's a 27-week program, so approximately $700. That fee does not fully cover their costs to run the groups, and it is even a barrier still at $25 a week for people to participate. Some programs are looking to insurance coverage to cover costs. That, too, is problematic. We have people without insurance still, and we also have a number of insurance providers who will not cover this service. Beyond that, transportation is a big issue. The distance between where people are living and where programs are at is prohibitive. It's well over 2 hours one direction in certain parts of the state to reach a program. These are also in areas of the state with little or no public transportation. And then availability. The wait lists for programs is a problem. Depending on where the program is in their multi-week cycle, a person may have to wait a number of months before even be able to get into a program. And then the last thing that I would point out is we have a lack of diversity of programming. There are extremely limited options for non-English speakers. There are limited programs that are culturally relevant, and there are only a handful of programs in the state for women offenders.
I want to, members, I do want to move us along. We have our colleague, Representative Kunesh Pradeen, who's waited patiently, and I want to make sure we get her bill in. This is a really important, powerful bill, Representative O'Neill. I am certainly convinced. Your testifiers have laid out a very compelling argument, particularly in terms of the capacity issues that need to be built up in the state. And so, with your permission, I'd like us to move to questions and see if we can move take action. Well, actually, we're going to lay this over, but I do want to make sure. And so that means we're going to continue to have this conversation, by the way. But I want to see if there are any questions from committee members at this point. Chairman Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really like this bill. You actually mentioned CADA. It's headquartered in Mankato. When I was the program coordinator at the jail, they came in for free and ran a batterers program until, frankly, their caseload just got so heavy that they couldn't do so anymore. So to have the funding to do it is just a great idea. That was like Kate a lot. Thanks.
I concur, Chairman Considine. Having this kind of work be dependent on volunteers does not rise to the level that we need to be at. Chairman Pinto, and then Representative Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be quick in the interest of time. I've worked plenty with Mr. Matthews and certainly Ms. Richards, and I think this is great. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. My question is just, is part of the thinking here, maybe the side benefit anyway, is to raise the bar in terms of program quality and effectiveness and knowing that it works? And I'm thinking just, you know, I was prosecuting domestic violence work has kind of been was the bulk of the first part of my work as a prosecutor. And, you know, the judge would always order programming, and you kind of didn't really know how well that actually worked. You hope that it worked. But I guess I would hope out of this that there'd be best practices would be spread and a sense of, you know, and some measuring to actually figure out what is actually working versus just sort of hoping that something called programming is working. And I wonder if that's part of the point or a side benefit that is hoped for out of this very needed funding. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quickly, please. I see nods of the head.
Yes. I'll just address that really quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank you, Representative Pinto, for that question. Yeah, so we have been collectively working with OJP to come up with exactly that, so that the caveat is you have to understand, say, like on a Red Lake Indian Reservation, they have a very culturally appropriate program. So we don't want to be so fine-tuned to say you must follow this, because that's going to look different than any other program in the state. So with that flexibility, yes, we want to make sure that it actually is effective. And I believe that is an absolute component of this program that has kind of been discussed offline. It is alluded to in there that says the requirements of the OJP program will be developed. So in order for the grant to be disseminated, OJP will have some requirements and some follow-up and reporting requirements.
That's great legislation where we do more than just make an investment, but also help build long-term capacity with knowledge as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up, just maybe to Ms. Richards, Mr. Matthews. Is there, do we have a really solid knowledge right now of what would in fact constitute meaningful and effective programming, or do we, I guess I have the sense that we have some guesses as to that, but that part of it is the need to, in fact, fund programs, evaluate them, see what works, especially in Minnesota, certainly in all the different communities, a variety, but that we, the part of this is, to a certain extent, we have to be figuring out what is meaningful and effective through this funding as well, but maybe, Mr. Chair.
I think a powerful answer should probably take us a good 30 minutes, well, but quickly, and we will come back to this.
Yeah, Chair and Representative, to be extremely brief, I would say, both of those things are true. We know some of the elements that need to be present, and we have much more to learn.
Right. Absolutely.
Representative Ellison, and then we'll move forward.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to say I grew up in a home where there was domestic violence, and my mom was the recipient of that violence. For 5 years as a child, I watched it. And I can't tell you how important this program is to get before something. And I think you did a great job of talking about the lack of quality program access. As a guardian ad litem with Hennepin County, I watched as children, as the parents would wait at domestic abuse, the DAP program, the Domestic Abuse Project, there will be wait lists. And so this is really, really good. And I think you guys did a really great presentation of showing us what the picture actually looks like. So thank you.
Indeed. Thank you, Mr. Matthews and Ms. Richards. I look forward to continuing having this committee work with you. Representative O'Neill, thank you for bringing a really important bill forward. The chair at this moment, then we'll lay this bill over and we'll be taking this back up again before the end of the session. Representative Kunesh Bonin, House File 74. And I'm wondering, Representative Dean, if you would care to move that House File 74 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee, the intent will also be to lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I will move House File 74 to Ways and Means with the understanding that it may be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Chairman. Dean, Representative Kunesh Padin, welcome back again, or welcome back again. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good to be back here again today. Unfortunately, it always seems to be under a very sad situation. Today I'm here to present to you House File 74, and this is a bill that eliminates the exclusion of fifth-degree criminal sexual assault for intentionally touching the clothing covering the immediate area of the buttocks with sexual or aggressive intent. Representative O'Neill mentioned that Minnesota tends to be in the lead when it comes to progressive ideas and implementing safety measures for our people, but unfortunately there was this very intentional exclusion in the law, and we need to do everything we can this year to make sure that that is included as misdemeanor. This came to me and to my Senator Lane last year. One of our constituents was accosted at the gym, and if you don't mind, I'm going to read her statement. She was not able to be here with us today, and so this is her statement. On November 4th, 2017, I was with my husband as well as our five kids at our local Lifetime Fitness Center eating lunch and getting our kids ready for their swim lessons. While my husband was finishing cleaning up our lunch, I waited outside of the cafe with our children, ages 8, 7, 6, 4, and 1 at the time. As I was standing there holding my baby and talking with my older kids, a man walked up behind me and fully groped my buttocks. He continued to walk past, only glancing back for a second to smirk at me, and continued to walk toward the exit of Lifetime. I was frozen between chasing this guy down or getting my kids to their swimming lessons. This was the first set of lessons for our family after a traumatic, near-drowning accident after the summer. I chose to continue on with the lessons, and I would contact the police and Lifetime management after the lessons were completed, since the man looked to be leaving the premises. After we completed our lessons, I approached the Lifetime manager to report what had happened and discuss whether their course of action is in this type of situation. I was then informed that the man that I was reporting had not only groped me, but four other women at Lifetime in that one day. One of the incidents involved him walking into the women's locker room. The manager informed me that the perpetrator had been arrested and was in Fridley police custody. I called the police myself after arriving home to report my incident and drove down to the station to give a taped statement of what had happened to me. They asked if I would make an ID via photo lineup, which I was unable to make, having only seen his face for a split second while he was walking away from me. I asked if they would be able to get the video footage from Lifetime and use that coverage to press charges. I was told that I would need to talk to the investigating officer. I spoke with the investigating officer the next day to inquire if she would be able to acquire the video footage and I could provide exact time and location when the assault happened. She informed me that it didn't really matter, and this is when it gets important, because the man in custody would only be charged with one count of disorderly conduct because of the ways that the laws are written in the state of Minnesota. This prompted me to start looking into the way that the law is written regarding criminal sexual misconduct, and I was appalled to find that there is a specific exclusion in the criminal sexual misconduct in the fifth degree statute stating that, but does not include the intentional touching of the clothing covering the immediate area of the buttocks. All other areas of the criminal sexual misconduct code state that sexual contact includes the touching of intimate parts, and buttocks included, over the clothing or whatever.
Unfortunately, this experience at Lifetime, which is not my first experience with sexual assault, and I can tell you that being groped on the buttocks is just as demeaning, violating, and traumatizing as the other forms of assault that I have endured. But our law does not reflect that sentiment. If this exclusion were not in place, this man at Lifetime would have been charged with 5 counts of criminal sexual misconduct in the 5th degree in just one day, and not 1 count of disorderly conduct. A slap on the wrist as far as the law is concerned. While researching the criminal sexual misconduct laws, I discovered that this exclusion had been in place since the law was enacted in 1988. So it was very intentionally excluded at that point. Now, almost 30 years later, our laws should reflect what we know to be true. A non-consensual groping of the buttocks is sexual assault. It is time we change this law and make sure that the punishment fits the crime. The day that I was assaulted in November, I took time to pray that this horrendous act would somehow be used for good. I would never have imagined that I would have had the opportunity to share with our lawmakers my story and hopefully help enact change. I can say wholeheartedly I am thankful for what I have endured to just be able to bring this issue to your attention. Respectfully submitted, Jessica Goodwin. So this bill came up last year. It was heard both in the House, where it passed with full consensus, as well as in the Senate. Got caught up in those omnibus bills and didn't get passed. And so we're here today to once again ask you to make this law full, make this woman whole, and not to dismiss what she has gone through, as well as those other 4 women in just one day, and to send that message to those perpetrators that this is not acceptable and you will be held accountable to the full extent of the law.
Thank you, Representative. And we did post Ms. Goodwin's statement also on the committee webpage as well.
Thank you.
But thank you for sharing that. Two questions I want to call on Chair Johnson, relative to the actions last year, which you can tell us about, the intent and the support and anything else you think would be helpful at this point.
Mr. Chair, first of all, I want to thank Representative Kudish-Padin for bringing this bill back. It was a good bill put forward by a representative who's unfortunately no longer here. But it's a very important issue that we do need to take care of.
And to Ms. Goodwin for providing this statement and her courage in coming forward with this. And I just wanted to let members know that this is something that I've also seen in my career as a prosecutor. There was a man at the state fairgrounds that had done this a number of years ago in a case that we tried to prosecute. And again, he was able to escape liability because of the laws written this way. So this is certainly not just a one-time thing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Lesh.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Representative Kudish-Padin. And this may have been a mistake because I know you were reading her testimony, but the statement was that if we had changed this, he would have been charged with 5 counts of criminal sexual conduct, not 1 count of disorderly conduct. And what I can't figure out is why they couldn't have stacked the 5 counts of disorderly conduct and then just stack the sentences on top of it. Like, what county was this in,
thank you, Chair. Representative Lesh, I believe it was in Fridley, so that would have made it Anoka County. Why they didn't do it that way, I really can't tell you. I wish I knew.
Okay, well, thank you. And, Ms. Chair, some of the questions we have on this, there is the tendency to, affix the reason for a particular injustice, which she certainly experienced in this situation. I had the same, I won't disclose from who, but a woman I know very well went through a similar situation at the Y, holding a child with some creepy dude that I wish I knew who he was, but he skedaddled off. It's just the most ridiculous thing ever. Point being that these things need to be gone after. Even without this law, we need to go after these and stack the disorderly conduct counts. And maybe they said, well, we can't identify those other four or something like that. But we need to, because, you know, and even if we change the law, people could still get away with it if we can't identify and get jurisdiction over the people in these situations, too. So I just a little irritated about when justice goes unaddressed in situations like this and people get away with it. I know what I want to do to these guys, but the law does not allow that. So you're bringing this, and I appreciate that, and thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative O'Neill, I'm looking at you because you and I have had some conversations in general about the importance of changing the culture in our society. And this particular act for me really, because it's thought of, unfortunately, as norm behavior. So we've quote-unquote tolerated it for so long. And that results in reinforcing a culture here that I think the evidence is increasingly telling us leads to even more egregious victimization. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you for pointing that out. And that should be a theme that we're going to talk about continually through this session and maybe even into the next about changing culture. And I made a very passionate plea, particularly to the men that were buyers of sex and how that is actually feeding the sex trade, which is, you know, fueling the loss of particularly indigenous people, but many vulnerable children, whether they're in foster care, because the targeted group is that 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old boy or girl. So, yes, we absolutely need to take a stand. I think if there's nothing else that comes out of this session, but we begin to change culture, I'm satisfied with, you know, obviously we have to pass the budget too, but out of this committee, if we actually begin to shift the needle of respecting our fellow human being. And I actually have an incident that happened to my own daughter regarding this, and she still has not received justice. She was standing at a bus stop buying a ticket, and there was a small group of adult men and women nearby, and she made note of them and was sort of watching them to see what was going to happen next, turned her back to buy the ticket. Next thing she knows, she's being hit as hard as this person could possibly hit her on her buttocks. And laughing the whole way, and she was terrified because she's like, well, what happens now? You know, like, what are they trying to do? So she did what we Daniels women do. That's, you know, my brother Daniels, Brian Daniels. She stared them down instead of engaging verbally. To her credit, she didn't engage because who knows what would have happened then. But she reported, it was on video because she was right in front of one of the terminals where she was buying a ticket. And so the video was there. She went and reported it to transit police. I had a conversation with then Chief Harrington because they weren't really taking a lot of action. And part of it is because we have this exclusion. And she said, I felt incredibly, incredibly sexually violated. Yes, it was a girl, but it was a whole bunch of boys there egging her on. So it's not just men perpetrating this. It's this culture of disrespect of another human being. And my experience that with my own, you know, then 21-year-old daughter just trying to buy a bus ticket. So it's a pervasive issue. And I really appreciate the fact that you've pointed that out and that one of our goals of the committee in this session is to begin to shift that needle and change culture, because that's really what will do tremendous good for the state of Minnesota. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I agree, Representative O'Neill. Members, we are at the time of adjournment, and so the chair will lay House File. First of all, thank you, Representative Kunesh-Bedin, for bringing us this
thank
bill.
Thank you.
The chair will lay House File 74 on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And members, we will stand adjourned until tomorrow at our normal time, right back here in this room.